welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Quest for Community by Robert Nisbet. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Luke Sheehan, a professor of political science at Duquesne University, as well as editor of The University Bookman, a publication of the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal. He's the author of Why Associations Matter, The Case for First Amendment Pluralism, and he joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Luke, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Why is The Quest for Community by Robert Nisbet a great book?
Robert Nisbet published The Quest for Community in 1953, a very important year for the American conservative movement. And it is a great book because he almost perfectly diagnoses the pathologies of the modern world. So he makes an argument in that book that the human drive for community is the primary human drive. Freud saying that it's sex. You have other people saying it's ambition or whatever. But for Nisbet, all of that is subsumed underneath community. So human beings have lived in tight-knit communities for most of our history. We lived in small clans and tribal groupings, and that we are trying to get back that sense of community. That's the fundamental drive. And he perfectly diagnoses the modern age because he looks at mid-20th century America, and he looks at the rest of the Western world, including the totalitarian states in the East. And he says, everything I'm seeing right now is being driven by a quest for community. So why do we have totalitarianism in the Soviet Union? Well, because there's a drive there for community, for an absolute deep feeling of community. And the totalitarian state, why did it succeed? Because it promised that. Turns out it can't really deliver, and Nisbet's very clear that political powers can't deliver on their promise of community, but that is the primary drive. And so he looks around in 1953, and he says, I'm seeing the collapse or what will be the collapse of all of our social groupings. Everything you see around you is in decline in terms of our social groups. And the reason it's in decline is because the political state has taken over the functions of many of these social groups. And I think he's most prescient when he's talking about the family. He says the family has become a virtually meaningless association. Remember, he's writing in 1953. He says, but the family is collapsing. And the human race has never been without the family. We've never been without kinship groups. And he's saying, I'm watching it collapse. Why? Because the state has taken over its functions. And when it takes over its functions, its psychological significance is going to decline. And how does he know this? Because he's watched that happen. Through his studies of social history, he's seen that happen over and over throughout history. When the state takes over the functions of a particular group, that group declines precipitously. Its psychological significance declines. The loyalty of individuals to that group declines, and often at very, very great personal cost. So I said the state takes over the functions of the family and other social groups, but it can't deliver on many of the functions it tries to take over. So when the state it takes over education from the family, it doesn't do a particularly good job at this most of the time. And in the areas where public schools do thrive are areas where the families are very much involved, where the PTA meetings are full of parents, where parents help with homework and the like. So we just simply cannot extricate these functions from the family, although the state very much tried.
We're going to talk about all of that, the meaning of community, the family, the state, the pathologies of the modern world. Who is Robert Nisbet, the guy behind this book, and why people are still reading The Quest for Community today? Why do we still look to it for wisdom? Luke, let's start with a famous line. It's maybe the most famous line in the book. It's not the start of the book. It's partway through. But the line is this, quote, "The quest for community will not be denied, for it springs from some of the powerful needs of human nature, needs for a clear sense of cultural purpose, membership, status, and continuity," unquote. Why is that line so well known, and what is Robert Nisbet saying?
So what he's saying there is the quest for community is deeply ingrained in the human psyche. What's interesting is a lot of our research has only confirmed that thesis. So some interesting recent research on reasoning. You can't reason alone. There's a very good reason that Plato wrote his philosophy and dialogues, because it's how we actually think. We put forward a thesis, there's pushback against it, and back and forth we go. We cannot even reason without other people. And so this quest for community, this need for status, and what Nisbet means by that, for status, is sense of belonging, that we belong to something greater than ourselves. And he means that in a concrete sense. We're a member of a family. We're a member of a church. Heck, we're the member of a nation. That America is a great country, and it's great to be a citizen of it. Human beings need that status, and we will seek it out in whatever way we possibly can. And he gives a very good history in this book, and that he expands on in his later books, of how this quest for community plays out. So human races looked for community in war. Wars, of course, but the membership and the sense of community between members of a war band are very strong. That's been noted very early in human history. One of the great rivals to the kinship group early in human history is the war band, because you can get from the war band a very strong sense of community, an overriding sense of community and purpose. You're going to go out and you're going to defeat an enemy on the field of battle for your general. That's a very strong drive, or meets that strong drive for community in the human psyche. Politics has been another way that the human race has sought out this sense of community. We can come together under the state and be the same thing, and the state can provide us with rights, it can provide us with protection, it can provide us with a sense of purpose. Religion, another way in which we can seek community, and it ties us into a sense of belonging, our sense of a place in the whole universe. That's what religion can give us. And so this drive is very deep. It's not going away. Sometimes you read these kind of ridiculous explanations of tribalism or something like that, and they say, well, if only human beings would just stop seeking community, they wouldn't seek community in destructive ways. Well, that's not how it works. That's Nisbet's point. We will seek community. If we can't find salutary communities, we'll find destructive communities.
So this idea that people want communities or need communities, that doesn't strike me as a special insight. Of course we do, for all the obvious reasons, I suppose. What did Robert Nisbet bring to this conversation that was new and different?
So what he said is, a lot of the discussions of the exercise of political power takes place across a kind of a false dichotomy between the individual and the state. So we say, on one side we have state power, on the other side we have the individual, and state power can be used to oppress the individual. And of course that's true. But that's not quite how things have played out. So Nisbet says what the state power does is it pretends to champion the individual at the expense of all of these social groups. So it offers the individual individual rights. It offers the individual protection in a welfare state, so a security, economic security. But when it does so at the expense of the authority of all these other social groups. Now, the problem is the state simply cannot provide that sense of community. So we think it can. We'll feel very much a part of our nation. But that's not the satisfying sense of community that human beings really want. What we need are the face-to-face interactions, the sense of belonging. So his great insight was seeing that political power had been exercised in such a way that it undermined all of these communities. So you see in the 19th century, there's very much a great faith and the ability of the individual to rise above his circumstances, that the individual was kind of all-encompassing, that the individual was, we are all individuals in this kind of whole sense. And as these social groups declined, what you see is a crisis across all of the disciplines, whether you're looking at psychology, sociology, political science, theology, all of these look at the individual, and they start, by the 1950s when Nisbet's writing, they see a crisis for the individual. No longer are we describing the individual as the strong person who thrives through adversity. What we see instead is the lost individual, the individual who's adrift, the individual who can't find God because he doesn't have a strong religious community that can embed him in a theological tradition. He doesn't have a family that can give him a sense of confidence and purpose that then he can take forward into the world when he leaves the family. We don't have strong local communities with all of the economic ties that you have when you have a strong local community to help people thrive economically. So we don't see individuals that thrive in kind of the self-made man who thrives and starts his business. What we see are individuals who inherit some money and they use it to invest, or they have family connections. So when they start a business, they get some investments from and help from their friends and family. That's what we see. When you hear the story of somebody founding an own business and these great stories, inspirational, you scratch under the surface and what you see are people in strong, closely knit communities, networks of friends and family who help them out, who help them to thrive. And Nisbet really zeroes in. So he says, yeah, people will acknowledge communities and that, but all of our political structure, the entire way we think, ignores them, ignores their significance.
So this is a problem of alienation. Is Nisbet saying that we all lead lives of quiet desperation when we lose our communities?
That's right. So he's saying we lead these lives of quiet desperation because we lose our communities. We don't have any sense of where we belong. And he says when people become alienated, they lose a sense of belonging to the world around them. So one reason you might say, be patriotic. You know, our nation has 300 million people. It's a little hard to be closely connected with that. But the reason you might be patriotic is because of what you might call the chain of being. You have a close-knit family. You have a close-knit local community, and you hang your American flag outside your door, and so do your neighbors. And that connects you to this larger political whole, kind of by degrees. And so you might not realize that's going on psychologically, but that's what's going on. So when you become alienated, you're not close to your family, you don't have a sense of local community, you work from home and don't have a sense of friendship with your coworkers, you start to lose that connection to the larger world altogether. And this can play out in a couple of ways. Some people just become withdrawn. So you see rises and deaths of despair among communities who lose the sense of belonging. Nisbet's very fond of Emil Durkheim's work. Now, Emil Durkheim, Nisbet does a lot of work on him. He's very clear in his letters that Durkheim's an uneven thinker. he is very much a man of the left. But his great insight was he studied the sense of alienation in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And he saw that suicide rates skyrocketed among communities that did not have a strong sense of corporate belonging. Suicide rates are higher among Protestants than among Roman Catholics, because the Roman Catholic Church is very much an integrated hierarchy. So you are part of a church, a worldwide communion. But in Protestant circles, there is very much an emphasis upon individual faith. Well, the psychological outcome of that was actually drift. People felt adrift and alone. Kind of statistically speaking, you would find more people who did that. So you'd find higher rates of insanity, higher social pathologies, higher rates of suicide, all of these things among the communities that lost their sense of community, among those populations that became more individualized. So Nisbet sees this as a huge problem, and he's tapping into it, and he's again saying, look, everything we have in our political order, all of our rhetoric regarding the individual, all of our rhetoric regarding politics is ignoring this fundamental insight.
It seems like there's a paradox here, which is that the state and the individual flourish at the same time while the middle is decimated.
That's right.
That it elevates the individual rights and so forth. Meanwhile, state power, political power grows, and what you lose are Edmund Burke's little platoons.
That's exactly right. A lot of times we see state and individual as being kind of the opposite. So the state's going to oppress the individual, and we need individual rights to protect us from the state. And there's a little bit of truth to that. But what Nisbet's tapping into is he says, man, there's all of these little platoons. That's Burke's phrase. All of these little platoons that we have around us. And what the state does is it champions and enforces individual rights. But the first victims of these exercises of political power are these social groups. So they go after the authority of the family. They take education, the function of education, away from the family and away from churches and away from local communities. And they make establish these public schools and they run them at the state level. And so what you find is then it's as these local communities lose their functions, they lose their ability to be able to shape individuals, and individuals lose that shaping. They don't become strong individuals. They become weak individuals, individuals who are prone to not just on the one hand, withdrawal, suicide, all those social pathologies, if not just a general sense of alienation, wandering through life. You don't commit suicide, you don't do drugs, but you wander through life with a sense of quiet desperation. Or on the other hand, you choose a self-destructive form of community. So you join a revolutionary group. you join a gang. So we know that people who join gangs are way more likely to come from broken homes than those who come from intact homes. So when you come from a flourishing family, you have your sense of community. You don't need to find it in a gang. You don't need to find it in a revolutionary group. You have it already. But those revolutionary groups thrive upon individuals who are alienated from those, what Burke called the little platoons.
As we have this conversation in the 2020s, it sounds like you're describing the world we live in right now. And
that's right.
And yet Robert Nisbet, as you say, he wrote this book in 1953. He was about 40 years old when the book published. The 1950s have this reputation as a moment of peace and prosperity and so forth. What was he seeing in the 1950s that makes us think of our own time?
So what he was seeing there, and this is the fascinating thing, is you read that book, and I recommend that anyone who has not read it, go out and read it. And you read it, and you think it was written this year. You think what he's talking about just happened. It's incredibly insightful. So he says, look, it's 1953, and you got to keep that in mind. And he's looking around him, and he's saying, yeah, the family looks like it's intact. It looks like it's thriving. Here's the thing. The functions that it is historically performed have been taken away from it. It's only a matter of time before it collapses. And of course, it's, you know, the divorce revolution is right on the cusp. He's writing right before that all happens. No fault divorce and all of that. And the reason that happens, Nisbet would say, is we took away the functions of the family. And so, you know, he says, he's writing in 1953, we praise, you know, motherhood, we praise the family, and we're basically compensating how we've made these institutions functionless. So we've made them basically some sort of purposeless community that we praise, but it doesn't really do anything. We have public schools. We have welfare programs. He's writing in 1953, so this is before the Great Society, but it's after the New Deal. We have, instead of turning to your family, instead of turning to your social networks and voluntary associations to protect you in old age, well, we have the government. So your kids aren't going to take care of you. We're going to have Social Security take care of you. And so what is the point of the family? Other than the kind of initial generation of children, the state hasn't figured out how to do that yet. But other than that, what does it do? And sure enough, within a generation, the family starts to go into a very public decline. But Nisbet's kind of great insight is he's looking around and he sees all the signs are here. And he knows from his study of history, and he was very much a historically minded sociologist, he knows that when this happens to an institution, it collapses. So when this happened to the guilds, they collapsed. When this happened to the medieval cities, they collapsed. And when this happened to social classes, they collapsed. So he knows from his study of history, this is what will happen to the family, given what the state has done in taking away its functions.
Some of this sounds like the bowling alone thesis of Robert D. Putnam, who famously said, we're now at a point, and this was a couple decades ago in the 90s, he said, we're now at the point where people are more likely to bowl alone than they are likely to bowl in leagues. And he was making some of these same observations about individualism and the loss of community and so forth. Is Robert D. Putnam a kind of inheritor of Nisbet? Are there differences in their thought? Help us understand these two figures together.
Yeah, so Robert Putnam is a very important figure, and he's in some ways very much in continuity with Nisbet. There's some important differences, which I'll talk about, but he taps into and sees the trajectory that Nisbet identifies, and he sees the same thing. So his famous argument in his book, Bowling Alone, is exactly this. We bowl alone, so we've lost our civil society associations. We wanted to do something together. We go out and we join a league. You're going to want to go bowling. We don't just go bowling. How fun is that? You go and you join a league and you bowl with your league and you work together to get better at bowling. You make yourselves better and you compete with others. That's kind of what we do. So if we're going to work on our community, we join a community group. We don't just go out alone and do something. We work together. You want to found, and so he's very much kind of tapping into Tocqueville's insights, writing in the 1830s. He says, man, these Americans, they don't have aristocrats. As we do, as the English do, they don't have a strong government as the French do, but they accomplish all of the same things but they do it through communities, voluntary communities. So they want to do something, they just have a meeting, and they decide what they're going to do. Anything as banal as filling in a pothole on the road to founding a seminary or a school. And they form, they discuss what they're going to do, they come to an agreement on what ought to be done, and then they decide how they're going to do it. So they kind of form their own executive power, and they get it done. It's just extraordinary. It's Americans. They're amazing. And this continues throughout American history. Nisbet sees that because of state power, the growth of state power, that's coming into decline. And Putnam, writing at the end of the 20th century and up until today, just had a book come out a couple years ago, identifying the same trends. Now, the important difference between Robert Nisbet and Robert Putnam is that Putnam is very much a progressive. So he sees the progressive movement as caring about community, a national community, in fact, and that it was very good at kind of directing all of the lower communities, the smaller communities, the voluntary associations, towards the growth of the administrative state and doing things together, the we-ness of the American people. And he says, we see that growing and growing and growing throughout the 20th century. And so he kind of actually disagrees with Nisbet. He doesn't think the community's in decline in 1953. He thinks the we-ness, the community's growing up through the early 20th century and then starts to decline in the 1960s. And then we get more individualism and that sort of thing throughout the latter half of the 20th century. Now, I think where he just misses what Nisbet's insight is, Nisbet is looking at the growth of the administrative state, and he's saying what the administrative state is doing is it's turning all of these local communities. So think of the Boy Scouts and the Boy Scouts are founded kind of in the height of the Progressive Era. Late 19th, early 20th century, as are all of these other groups that are around today, the Rotary Club, all of these groups. They're founded, you know, amazing flourishing of social groups in the early 20th and late 19th centuries. Putnam sees that as very much a part of the progressive movement, all about we-ness, and that's why all these social groups are founded. And Nisbet actually sees them at the progressive movement as co-opting them. So what you have is throughout the 19th century, you have a massively destructive war, the Civil War, of course, a necessary war, I think, but massively destructive in terms of what it does to society. So Nisbet's America is gone. And we end up with major economic changes, the Industrial Revolution. And so Tocqueville's America is gone, no longer these voluntary associations and local communities. But then what you get is the reweaving of the social fabric, the founding of all these new voluntary associations in the late 19th century, and Americans' kind of sense of community, small communities, reweaves itself throughout all of these groups, Boy Scouts, all of these things. They come together. Now, then the problem is you have these groups start to be concerned with political matters. Now, Putnam sees that as a really good thing. That's exactly what all these small social groups should do. Don't be concerned with things like reading Dante or going on hikes. Be concerned with creating good citizens of the state. Be concerned with what's going on at the national level, with getting legislation through Congress. Well, Nisbet saw that turning the eyes of all of these social groups away from local matters, away from their local communities, away from their members, their individual members, and towards the national state could really backfire. What it would mean is these groups would give over their functions to the state. They wouldn't be about being a part of your local Rotary Club, because the local Rotary Club was just about discussing congressional legislation. Well, you know, I don't see why I need my local Rotary Club if that's all we're going to do. I can, you know, read the news and, in our day and age, I can write letters to the editor or comments on posts. I don't see why I need my local Rotary Club. And so actually, Nisbet sees that by turning, politicizing all of these local groups, it was undermining them. Now, it would take decades to play out, but it would, in fact, play out that way. And I think Putnam really misses this insight that Nisbet brings to the table. So he thinks Nisbet is wrong on seeing the decline of social communities in the 1950s. But I think what Putnam's missing out on is that the progressive state was undermining them, taking away their functions. Even while our rhetoric was all about we and us and all of that, and we get kind of the epitome of that with Kennedy, it was already being undermined by the administrative state. And Nisbet has its number all the way back in 1953, and Putnam still, I think, misses that today.
It sounds like Nisbet would be a believer in the American principle of federalism or the Catholic principle of subsidiarity. Is that true? And did he have a political program? So he outlines the problem. Did he offer in The Quest for Community a solution?
Yeah, so he does offer a solution, and he doesn't talk a whole lot. And Nisbet was a very interesting guy. He was not religious at all. So he did go to church in his 30s to the Episcopal Church, but he seemed to just not have that button. But what he says bears a very strong resemblance to subsidiarity in the Catholic tradition or sphere sovereignty in the Protestant tradition. So these are they're very similar. You might call them kissing cousins. That's how I've heard them described. And they're the understanding that you want things handled at the local level as much as possible, and that God has created not just the political community, that he did create that, but he also created the family. He created the church, and that these communities have their own functions. And the role of the larger community, so the role of, say, the nation state, the role of the United States government, is to help those local communities thrive, is to not co-opt them, not to take over the family's functions, not to control the family and direct it towards itself, but rather to help the family thrive, to provide a sense of autonomy so that the family can thrive. So Nisbet was very much a fan of the American constitutional tradition because he saw it as a tradition of plurality. So federalism, that's what he means by plurality. Federalism. We don't just have a centralized sovereign state. We in fact have a bunch of different sovereignties. We have the state governments, but they're not completely sovereign because we have a national government and it's not completely sovereign. And not only that, but we have constitutional provisions that actually constrain state and federal governments so that local communities and social groups like religious groups and families can thrive. So we have very much a plural society. Nisbet does have a term for this. He calls it the laissez-faire of groups. And what he means by that is we're going to have a system where groups compete against each other. Now, he doesn't elaborate a lot on what he means by this and the quest for community. He just says this should be our guiding vision. How can we have these different centers of authority, social authority and political authority, such that they can work in together to compete for the function and loyalty of individuals. So why am I a member of my church and not a different church? Because my church provides a strong sense of community. My church directs me towards worship of the divine in an important way. I'm a Reformed Christian and a Presbyterian. So my church offers that. So other people say, well, the Catholic Church offers that. And Nisbet would say, and that's good when they're competing with each other, kind of a race to the top and who can provide the best sense of community. And so that should be our guiding principle. So he doesn't elaborate a lot on that in Quest for Community. You're going to have to turn to his 1975 book, Twilight of Authority, where he goes into a little more depth in the last chapter in that book on what this could mean. And so he gets a little bit more into a political program there. So what we want is to focus on the local. So he would be very much a fan of federalism. How can we increase federalism, the power of state governments in our society? But not just, don't stop there. How can we increase the authority of local communities, of local cities, to thrive and make their own decisions? But don't stop there. How can we have families that thrive? But don't stop there. How can we have religious communities that thrive? And don't stop there. How can we have local businesses that thrive? So how can we have all of these different institutions in these different spheres of our lives? How can we help them thrive? And what does that mean? Does it mean decreasing regulation? That might be one thing. Does it mean giving subsidies? Highly unlikely, because when the government gives money, it makes institutions dependent on the government. That's probably not going to be a very good idea. But what can we do? And this should be our guiding vision. So he does outline a vision of what a laissez-faire groups does. He doesn't go into a lot of detail, so it's kind of left to those of us today to start filling that out.
Luke, you've written a lot about Robert Nisbet. You're an expert on the guy. How did you discover him and become so intrigued and attracted to his ideas that you took up scholarship on Robert Nisbet?
Well, I first read The Quest for Community pretty early in my adult life, and I read it because it's an important book. It's an essential part of the conservative canon. I read it, it's fine. And then I started studying Supreme Court case law in grad school, and I ended up writing my dissertation and my first book on the subject, and I saw that the freedom of association case law is not very good. The Supreme Court has really made a mess of it. And I was trying to figure out what had gone wrong in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, and I reread The Quest for Community for very different reasons at that same time. And it dawned on me that just how brilliant Nisbet's thesis was. So he's speaking in very broad terms of what's going on broadly in our society, and I saw it in microcosm in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the First Amendment, that it was championing individual rights, and it could only see the autonomies protected in the First Amendment in terms of the individual. So what the Supreme Court does is it completely ignores the Assembly Clause. The Supreme Court has essentially written that clause out of its jurisprudence, hasn't touched it in decades. And it does so, I argue in my book, Why Associations Matter, because it focuses only on freedom of speech and it collapses the right of association, which ought to be protected, and the right of assembly. You should go read John Inazu's book, Liberty's Refuge, from 2012. Great book on the Assembly Clause and why it's so important and why it's been ignored. This right should have been protected in the Assembly Clause, but the court cannot see it. Why can't it see it? Because the Assembly Clause is a right of social groups. You can't assemble by yourself. You can speak by yourself. You can read your Bible by yourself. Maybe you can even make a publication by yourself. You cannot assemble by yourself. It has to be at least one other person, or it's not an assembly. It's just some guy standing by himself. So the right of assembly is protecting this communal, relational right. And the court just misses that. Why does it miss it? Because it has the blinders on that Nisbet identifies, the state and the individual. I call it the First Amendment dichotomy. And so I saw how Nisbet diagnosed Supreme Court jurisprudence that, of course, was going to come after he writes in 1953. All the problematic jurisprudence is mostly after that. But he diagnoses it right there. And he offers a solution. So in my book, I use his understanding to diagnose what's wrong in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, and then I use Nisbet's solution. So he argues in, I basically take the idea of a laissez-faire of groups he talks about in Quest for Community and elaborates on in Twilight of Authority, and I apply that to the Supreme Court jurisprudence. So here's what we got to do. We got to go in and we got to figure out a way to protect the functional autonomy of these associations. It's not about speech and freedom of association, and I'm a huge fan of freedom of speech, but that's just not what we're talking about. What we're talking about are the associational rights of these groups. We need to figure out a way to protect their functional autonomy. That's Nisbet's term, and that's the term I use in my book and say we need this to get this into our jurisprudence.
Luke, you're the editor of the University Bookman. Very quickly, what is the University Bookman, and how can listeners read it?
The University Bookman was founded in 1960 by Russell Kirk, the great conservative thinker, author of The Conservative Mind. It is a publication. It's all online, so you can access everything we've ever published there. And what it does is it seeks to redeem the time by identifying and discussing books that diagnose the modern age, books like The Quest for Community, and support the renewal of culture and the common good. So we publish two new reviews and essays every week, and we're trying to very much follow in the steps of Russell Kirk. That's my goal as editor, to follow in the steps of Russell Kirk and Gerald Rossello and identify books that are very good and that help preserve a humane culture in America.
Russell Kirk and Gerald Rossello and Robert Nisbet were all contributors to National Review, so it's nice to have their names mentioned here on this podcast. One final question about The Quest for Community by Robert Nisbet. Is it worth reading today? It's one thing to understand its ideas, maybe read a summary. Is the book itself worth reading, and why?
It is absolutely worth reading. And the reason it's worth reading is his argument there is not particular to 1953. In fact, as I said, it's only become more relevant as time is going on. I could see where somebody in 1953 would say, well, I don't know, the families look like it's doing okay today. But how's the family faring now? You read his summary of the family and you realize just how much he nailed it in terms of what was going to happen, what was coming down the pike. He has a great discussion of how friendship has declined. Writing in 1953, and he says, we care more about the superficial symbols of friendship than actual real concrete friendships. And I have written in the margins in my copy of The Quest for Community, Facebook! Our Facebook friends. That's what he's anticipating half a century before Facebook will be invented. And so it's incredibly prescient. And what he's talking about is not just what's happening in the 1950s. What he's talking about is what had happened in the previous centuries that led up to the problems of the 20th century, which have only become more relevant today. So you get to learn about Jean-Jacques Rousseau and how Rousseau laid the theoretical groundwork for the collapse of community and exercise of political power in the inappropriate ways in the 20th century and the 21st century, frankly. It's only gotten worse. And you read about all that, it really lays the groundwork for that in a way that is in no way, shape, or form bound to the middle of the 20th century. It's just as relevant, if not more so, today.
Luke Sheehan, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Quest for Community by Robert Nisbet.
Thank you very much.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through our website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. And last of all, a special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.